all of the government programs that we don't like are funded by theft. All of the government programs that we do like, oh, sorry, there aren't any. Government is the reason that healthcare is expensive. Government is the reason you can't go to college. Taxation is theft.
And welcome back to Taxation is Theft, the show that talks about all the ways the government is ripping you off and oppressing you. Broadcasting live on Facebook and YouTube from an underground bunker deep within the jungles of Mexico, I'm Dan Taxation is Theft Berman, former candidate for President of the United States, currently in the race for Governor of Texas. And tonight, Carl Gallagher is a science fiction and fantasy writer whose stories wrestle with why and how people have governments. Why? I don't know. I've never been able to answer that myself. Including a planet that runs on voluntary contributions. And a displaced... That part sounds really awesome, actually. And a displaced group of hobbyists finding leadership they had for their play is now in charge of their survival. He also looks at what new oppression we may see in the future, which kind of reminds me of 1984. So this should be interesting. And his first trilogy was nominated for the Libertarian Prometheus Award, which is really awesome also. But before we get started, if you're watching the live stream, make sure to like and share. If you're on Facebook, start a watch party. If you're on YouTube, share it to your Twitter. Get some other people in to watch this, because this is really awesome. And if you saw recently, YouTube's already been banning a lot of people, and so they've been suppressing our stream too. Interestingly enough, and we've seen that from our past shows. Our reach is going down and down and down. So we really need a little bit of elbow grease in here. Help us get some reach in front of some other people by sharing the video and hit the algorithms hard by liking and commenting. And of course, while you're watching, if you have any questions or comments, then make sure you type those into the comments. We will see them here. Sometimes we read them. Sometimes we answer them if they're questions. Egg us on. And of course, head over to taxationistheft.info. That's our merch store that has all kinds of really cool stuff, like this Taxation is Theft hat that I'm wearing that you've seen everywhere. And we've got all kinds of other really cool stuff there that you're going to like. And that's it for all the boring talk. Let's get on to the show. Carl, how's it going? Oops, hold on. I forgot to unmute you again. Let's try that again. Carl, how's it going?
It is going well for 2020.
Maybe that's why I keep forgetting to unmute people. It's 2020. That would explain so much. So let me remember something to start off by asking something that I keep forgetting to ask at the beginning of every show. Which tax do you hate the most?
Okay, this is petty. It's really petty. There are much more important taxes that are a bigger problem. But the one that annoys me the most is my hometown charging me $25 a year for the privilege of uploading books to Amazon for all of you to buy.
What? You know,
I'm already paying. I'm doing this from my house. I'm doing this from the very computer that I'm talking to you right now. So, you know, I'm already paying my property taxes and sales taxes for the roads and paying my water fees, paying all that stuff.
Your FCC
tax. And then on top of that, they charge me $25 because I have a business. And of course, I registered my business with the state of Texas, which is how they found out about that, because they, if you buy my book from Amazon, Amazon takes care of the sales taxes. I don't have to worry about that. If I actually physically hand you a book, I am legally required to give some money to the state of Texas. They have finally, recognized that I am a small enough business that it was costing them more to process my paperwork quarterly. So now I only have to do this annually, because honestly, it probably costs them a lot more to pay somebody to process my paperwork than I was paying them in sales taxes. And, On top of that, there's the hours I was spending figuring out their system and keeping track of every sale to the dollar. Actually, that to the penny, because...
The worst.
Yeah. So the sales tax is irritating, but, you know, the state of Texas collects sales taxes, and unlike Tennessee, they don't have something where... Okay, if you're collecting, you know, less than $1,000 in sales a year, don't bother us. Tennessee has a little exit there. Texas, no, you sell a dollar, we want 8 cents. It's like, well, you know, it's a government. But then the city I live in is charging me $25, and it's just totally out of the blue because they can. So that's the most annoying tax.
That is pretty annoying. And that's a flat amount. So if you're, let's say, a hobbyist who every once in a while you go out to like a farmer's market or something and sell like one or two things that you made, and they're going to charge you for that $25. If you sell $25 worth, that's 100% tax. That's insane.
Well, yep.
That's insane. Yeah. No, yeah. That's not petty at all. I mean, that's petty of them.
Yeah.
That's seriously annoying. And what would happen if you didn't do this? What kind of threats do they back that up with?
Well, there was no threats, but it's just very implicit that, you know, if I don't pay them, I'll get another letter, and then I'll get a third letter. And if I blow off enough letters, eventually some guy in a black uniform with a gun at his hip is going to knock on the front door and say, hey, here's how much you owe the city and the penalties and late fees and everything, you know, cough it up. And, you know, I don't want to put my family through that, so I pay. You know, not because it's right, not because it's just, not because they, you know, are going to put the money to good use. I am complying with this extortion because I don't want to put my family through the hassle.
Yeah. That's, a lot of people don't get that it's, you know, they haven't sent the guy with the gun yet, but it's implicit. And, that sucks, man.
Well, you know.
Well, that's where I'm running for governor, so we can get rid of sales taxes and property taxes.
All right.
So tell me about your book or your books.
Okay. I have 6 out so far. That's going to be 7 in a few weeks. First 3 are the Torchip trilogy, Torchip, then Torchip Pilot, and Torchip Captain. This one starts out as a kind of Firefly type space adventure. You have your, you know, crew of a freighter just trying to make enough money to keep themselves in the sky. And then it brings in the bigger issues of humanity is fractured between a central oppressive government, you know, not an evil empire, but just a very bureaucratic democracy. And then you have the various worlds that are not under that government and are having to put up with attempts to be brought under control, which eventually turns into open warfare. And the problem is, you know, they're doing all this while there's already warfare between, you know, humanity and the artificial intelligences that destroyed Earth and forced everybody to flee to the stars, because, you know, the bureaucrats just can't, you know, focus on one problem. They have to try and get control of everybody, even when there's all this other stuff going on. So in the course of which you have some planets which are, you know, the outer planets are, you know, the disconnected worlds, because they are not connected to the fusion, which is the big government. And they all have their own thing. The heroine is from a fairly boring bicameral democratic government. The captain is from a world where they solve governments and taxation at the same time by simply auctioning off positions in the government. So you want to be a senator, pay more than, you know, other folks. If you're one of the top 100 bidders, you get a seat in the Senate.
That's kind of how it works, so not that, here in the U.S., right?
It just cuts out the middleman, you know. And, of course, you know, it operates a bit differently as a government because they're spending their own money. So, which is a lot different from people spending other stuff. There's another world in the setting, which unfortunately we didn't get to visit in the course of the plot I had. But if there's another story in the setting, I may go there, where they essentially have pedestrian democracy. If you buy a chunk of land, you can set up whatever type of government you want. And so they wind up in a pseudo-feudalistic nested governments, where if you become the local baron, you can run it any way you want, including being, you know, total personal tyrant, and you can do whatever you want except keep people from leaving. So that's the feedback, that's the constraint on government. If people don't like your system, they're out.
That's yeah, that's always nice. That, I mean, it's unfortunately it's the if you don't like it you can leave model.
It's, and it can be very expensive. I mean, for me to move someplace else, you know,
well, yeah, if
moving the family,
about,
moving the job, you know, it's, yeah, it's expensive, but you can.
From in this is like a from planet to planet kind of thing, right?
Well, no, this would be just within the planet.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I was going to say, I'm going to go off on a tangent here because I'm sure there's we'll come back to this. But this already sounds interesting. But like that idea, I've always had this kind of this idea of a, you know, what happens if somebody created an island and they set up like, you know, whatever kind of government they want and there's taxes and everything, but they're the only person there. But then people voluntarily go to that island, understanding that they're going to have to pay taxes and agreeing to all the laws and rules and everything that are there. But the, and like you said, they'd be able to leave. But at the same time, it's like, what happens when they have kids that are now on that land and in that system? And they're like, well, I want to leave. Well, if you want to leave, you're going to have to earn some money first. And that's just the way the world works. And it's kind of like, I think that's where that system kind of breaks down, because now you're introducing new people who haven't had that contract.
Yeah. And every system's going to break down. I think part of it is we're fundamentally running up against the laws of thermodynamics. You know, the fact that you need to eat, that you need resources to keep a roof over your head, is going to constrain you, and it's going to constrain people in groups. And if there's a government, it's going to constrain the government. This is something I addressed more directly in my fantasy story, The Lost War, and its sequel, The War Revealed. You've got a bunch of historical reenactors, something like an SCA group, and a magic spell flips them to another world, and here they are in the wilderness with orcs and dragons and elves running around. But their initial thing is, we were just going to spend the weekend camping out here, and then we were going to go home. So we've only got 3 days worth of food, and how the hell are we going to keep from starving to death? And that's something that requires effort and organization. And so they wind up having their pretend government for their hobby, having to be in charge of the real decisions they need to survive. You know, who's collecting food? Who's carrying the shit out to the sewage dump? And, you know, and the last one is a much harder argument to solve. But, you know, if you don't have somebody taking care of the ship, you know, this camp of a couple hundred people is going to be unlivable.
Right.
So what are you all going to do? Disperse? Well, you know, dispersal can work. I mean, we've had that, but you can only support so high a lifestyle with one family on their homestead. You need to interact with a larger group if you want to have a modern lifestyle. And that means much more complicated stuff. And that means agreements among large group of people. And whether you call it a social contract or not, it's, you know, you're going to be forming a group. It's going to be a society and you're going to have to deal with it. And one of the things we've seen through history is there's good ways and bad ways to deal with that. And we're doing a hell of a lot better now than we were 1,000 years ago. So I will take that and be thankful. And I remind my kids of that whenever they complain too much about how things are in the present day.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I've heard several different people throughout this statistic that we're living in the most peaceful time now than ever before, as much crap that we have to deal with. The number of people dying in wars is at an all-time low. Theft, robbery, murder, all that stuff is at an all-time low globally. So I think that's kind of helpful and interesting. But it doesn't help that we have the media is broadcasting more of it because they found we love watching that stuff and they can get, you know, that's how they get our eyeballs to stick on their channel and that's how they make all the money from their advertisers. So their framing of the world makes it look a lot worse than it is. Not worse than it is, because it is actually that bad, but relative to what we used to think it was, I think.
Well, some of that is, call it a design flaw in the human brain, which mm-hmm. isn't a flaw so much as when you've got 100 people roaming the savanna, watching out for leopards, with any detection system, you can have false positives and false negatives, which for those in the audience not used to some of the technical jargon, you know, if you see a bush blowing in the wind and you think it's a leopard, that's a false positive. If there's a leopard standing there and you think it's just a bush, that's a false negative in your leopard detection system. And so we have trained to have our system have many more false positives than false negatives, because a false positive upsets you and wastes your time, and a false negative eats you. So we really, really don't want false negatives. And so what we have is a new system that gives us lots and lots of false positives, because they get more clicks on their website for a false positive than for a truthful negative.
Right.
When COVID cases double, you know, when COVID death rates double, big headlines. But at the same time, there was a wave this summer and that wave stopped and we've got another wave increasing. But we didn't have big headlines about COVID death rate halved from, you know, the August peak.
Right.
Well, we didn't have, go ahead.
What's interesting about that too is when they were talking about how they designed the tests, it wasn't like a binary test, yes or no, right? It's a scale. And they said the mm-hmm. way that they calibrated everything was so that you would have a lot more false positives, because for that same reason, well, their argument was they didn't want any false negatives, because a false negative could potentially be a threat to other people. They could think, oh, I don't have it. I can walk around and not wear my mask and go see my grandmother, and they're going to spread it because it's a false negative. And so the argument was, let's have a lot of false positives. And I think that's really interesting, because that's playing to that same argument that the false positives are good. Because if everybody thinks they have it, they're going to, you know, hide in their homes and self-quarantine for 2 weeks. But if nobody thinks they have it, then they're just going to go out, you know, situation normal and spread it everywhere.
Well, yeah, and there's, what's the actual punishment here? Because you're talking about the FDA approving COVID tests. And what's the FDA afraid of? Someone walking around spreading the disease? Or are they afraid of getting called in front of a congressional committee and yelled at for having a bad test? Well, what's a senator going to grandstand about? It's like, there were people with spreading COVID and your test said they were healthy. They're right. A lot more likely to throw a fit over that. So that's the error the FDA goes in. And, you know, and I could rant at length about the FDA, but I'm sure you've probably had guests much better suited for that than me.
Yeah. I was actually thinking about calling Dr. Mary Ruart back to have her on about the vaccine next week. That would be really interesting. Yeah, it is really interesting that, you know, how that plays out. But like you said, it's interesting the language you're using, because you referred to it as a detection system, that's really what it is. Like when we're focused on the TV and we see all these things, oh, we're supposed to be afraid of this, and it gets our attention, and then we have to watch it, and then we listen to all the information, and next thing you know, we're brainwashed. Like, that really is playing off of our detection systems that are the same ones that, like, you know, you're walking through your house and you see a spider and you start freaking out. That's what it is. There was a really interesting experiment that somebody did that, like, it was like they had a bunch of pictures and they were flashing really fast. And then they asked you to name the things that you saw in those pictures. And everybody would name things like spiders and snakes and you know, all the scary, ugly things that we don't like. And then when they played it back in slow motion, there were other things like flowers and hearts and like all this other stuff. But nobody saw any of that, because the stuff that really stood out was the stuff that that fired off our detection system.
Yeah, we are trying to run 21st century software on hardware designed for hunter-gatherers. And yeah, that gets us some interesting bugs.
Yeah. Well, maybe Elon Musk will fix that when he comes up with the brain implant that he's working on.
You know, if Elon wants to try, I'm for it. I was cheering. I was watching the SN8 flight live, and I was cheering even as it crashed, because, you know, they managed to crash right on the center of the landing pad. And I've worked rockets. I started out as a rocket engineer in aerospace, and that's hard. I mean, that was really impressive work by SpaceX. Now, Elon comes out with a brain implant. I'm probably going to wait for version 2.0 or 3.0 before I sign up for that.
Right. Yeah, I'm definitely not going to be first in line for that.
Yeah. Now, there are people that are, and God bless them, we need the volunteers. We you know, need to have folks willing to be out there on the cutting edge. And, you know, when I was half the age I am now, I might have signed up for that. But now I have a wife and kids to take care of, so I don't get to go do really fun, exciting experiments like that. You know, which is also why I'm working a much more boring job than rockets these days. So all of my rocketry goes into the books.
Nice. Tell me how does this work? You said you've got a book that's about part of one of the books where there's a society that's based entirely on voluntary contributions, and I would hope also voluntary associations. Is this a libertarian utopia kind of thing?
It's probably as close as I've ever written to a libertarian utopia. I wouldn't want it to be a utopia because I figure if I write either a utopia or a dystopia, I've failed in my job, because it has to be more complicated than that to be interesting. So the planet Bonaventure, you know, has, you know, this auctionocracy system where they auction political offices off. And the captain of our merry band of adventurers had at one point in his life served as senator, because the Spacers Guild would pass the hat and raise some money so they'd have one guy in the Senate to make sure that the laws were reasonable for spacers, so that there could be decent rules for handling ships going on and off the planet. And where we see that getting strained is when the war breaks out and these people are facing serious threat, then they start pressuring each other to up their contributions. So I have a scene where they describe a dinner party where someone stands up and says, "I'm a quarter share man. I'm donating a quarter of my income to the war effort." And people at the table are standing up and saying, "Yeah, I'm donating a quarter," until the remaining people are pressured to make their commitment to donate much more than they had been. Is that taxation? Well, not yet, because they don't have someone with a gun coming to their door to make them pay that up. But, you know, if people get crankier about it, you know, are there going to be, you know, is there going to be social consequences, what nowadays we call getting canceled, if someone, you know, says he made a donation and didn't? Are there going to be lynch mobs enforcing donations? And that's because you have this group facing a large outside threat. And in the book, the planet actually does get invaded and occupied, you know, in the course of the series before they're later liberated, thanks to the action of the protagonist, because that's how adventure novels work. But, you know, these people are pressuring each other to do their part. And so I want to show that even if you don't have a coercive government that's collecting taxes, the forces that lead to a government forming and taxes being enforced, they're still going to be there if you have a threatening situation. You know, if you have a collection of people who need to survive, they're going to do what it takes to survive. And the question is, how can we find a way to assure our survival, whether it's from an outside power in coming invading with guns or dealing with the disease, which is this year's big problem, or whatever else comes along, how do you manage to handle that problem? You know, and from the libertarian point of view, how can you do it in the least coercive way? And, you know, in the Bonaventure case, you know, if enough people are donating to meet the needs of the military to fight off the enemy, then you're kind of doing it like the Kickstarter system. Enough people donated, it happens, you can go forward. You know, but if that system fails, then people are much more likely to go to a coercive option than to just give up and let themselves get killed. So that's kind of the big problem of libertarianism. How do we, you know, come up with options that people will go through and be sure of their survival, so that we can, you know, minimize the amount of petty government just taking stuff because they can and handing out guns to people who will abuse us because they can.
Right. And that's interesting too, because you're talking about a situation where there's actually a social pressure to take money from other people. And I think ultimately that's what we have today just with kind of the government acting as a middleman for that, because ultimately you have, you know, the government, they tell us there's all these things we need to be afraid of. The world's going to go to hell. Like, all these criminals are going to break into our houses if we don't pay our taxes and have the police and, you know, all these other things. If we don't have the national defense, our kids are going to be stupid if we don't pay for the schools. And so there's a social pressure. And so what's interesting is, like, it's not just the government that says we want to collect taxes. There are, like, there's a large portion of the population that support the government in doing that, that say everybody else should be giving money to the government because the government does good things. And so ultimately, yes, it's a government force that's stealing from us, but that is backed by a social force, which is, I think, exactly what you're describing. So in some way, that's kind of like the maybe the way that you know, that if, okay, this is one thing I've said, where if we got rid of the government completely today, the people who want that government would create another one tomorrow. And so if we don't figure out how to make those people happy without having that government, then the government that we have is just never going to go away. That's the way to get it, is to get to if you want to get rid of the government or any part of it, you have to get rid of the desire to have it, and you have to have you have to come up with an alternate way to make those other people happy. And I know there's a lot of resistance even in the libertarian movement to that idea. Like, why should I make them happy? I don't have any obligation to make them happy. But the reality is you're born into an environment with all of these people who have built this destructive system. And if you want to fix the destructive system, even if that means getting rid of it, you have to fix the desires of the people who wanted and created that system. Otherwise, it's just always going to be there. It's not just going to, like, it's not like you can just bury your head in the sand and it's going to go away.
Yeah. I mean, there is the option of exit. You know, we were talking about Elon Musk's rocket earlier. You know, there are going to be people going to Mars because, you know, I'm going to find myself a crater and I'm going to take over this crater and live here with nobody bothering me. There are people talking about seasteading, where you mentioned earlier building an artificial island. There are people working on designs for that, Patrick Friedman and the Seasteading Institute. So going off on your own, setting up your own system, you know, a lot of the early European colonization of America worked in just that way. You know, of course, you know, some people were not so much coming here for freedom as wanting to set up a system where they could oppress other people that they wanted to oppress, rather than being on the receiving end. Plenty of stuff on that in history. So space travel, sea travel, you know, unfortunately, Antarctica has been placed off limits by various governments. So, you know, that's not a place to go homestead. You know, but exit is kind of the solution for that. And I think it succeeded because, I mean, as much as you and I have been complaining about the U.S. government in the course of this conversation, it's still doing a hell of a lot better than most of the governments that our ancestors fled from. I mean, yeah, we complain about the gun control laws. You know, my grandparents came from, what was then the United, you know, came from United Kingdom, which is now having knife control.
Right.
You know, and they're, you know, they'll take your garden trowel because it might be a weapon. You know, and I'll admit, I could mess somebody up with a garden trowel.
Right.
But it's not my first choice.
Right.
And so, you know, that wave of exit has made the U.S. a more successful, you know, free government than a lot of the other ones out there. And hopefully people who emigrate to the moon when that becomes cost effective want to go to Mars. And, you know, I think Elon Musk's technology would be a lot more useful for getting to the moon, you know, cheaper. But, you know, problem is the moon's pretty close to Earth, so you can't be that sure of avoiding interference from governments. And there's been some good stories written about that.
Right. You got to get far enough away. But this is interesting, too, because like even the exit strategy, right, that's still a concept of no man's land, right? You're finding no man's land and you're taking it for your own. And what's interesting is like governments will tend to say, well, that's not really no man's. Yeah, you're a couple people who are on that land, but that's not really yours. It's still no man's land. And us as the government are now going to take it over. And I think that's how, you look at the United States and how, you know, all these states were taken over from indigenous people who are already living there. Like, oh, no, you don't have a government, so you don't have property rights. But then the government now owns all of this land. And, you know, it's really like to the point where, like, if you have a big enough military force, you just take a map and draw a circle and say, this all belongs to me. So, you know, what's to stop the United States from saying, well, the moon already belongs to us. We already put a flag up there, you know, a few decades ago. That belongs to us. So even if you landed there, we'd still be able to tax you. And of course, that's limited by their ability to probably send some people up there and build an IRS field office. But it's like, it really is like that. It's like who's going to get more people there first? Who's going to build a military to protect it from you know, the IRS coming and setting up an office there?
Yeah, exit is hard. You have to go far enough away that it's not going to be, you know, not necessarily impossible, but not cost effective.
Right.
For the government to come after you. And, you know, there is the problem that whatever technology made it possible for you to get to Mars is also going to be available for the United States to get to Mars. Now, for science fiction writers, it's like, well, what if I invented a good space drive and kept it secret? And that way the government won't be able to follow me. Well, great option if you can pull it off, but that's hard to do. It does make for some fun books. The guy who beat me out for the Prometheus Award with Travis Corcoran with The Powers of the Earth wrote about very much that scenario where someone invented an anti-gravity drive and used it to set up a colony on the moon of anarchists, which... has trouble. And of course, the plot of the book is, you know, Earth, you know, the governments on Earth figuring out how to follow them. And it's a fun read, but it's, you know, exactly the problem here. You know, the problem with exit is you keep on having to exit farther and farther out, and they will come after you. And we have an analogous problem, you know, here in Texas, where someone will decide, I don't want to deal with the mayor. I'm going to move on out to the country and just get my set up a trailer on some empty land and have nothing. And then they get this letter that says, hi, the city of Fort Worth has annexed this chunk of land. You know, start paying taxes and we'll get you a sewer connection sometime in the next few years. And there's been some fights here, but that is, you know, that is a power that cities have exercised to annex other communities. So exit is hard.
Yeah, that's really exactly it. Now, if you would have, declared, you and some of your neighbors, you got together and declared it your own city. But of course that city, it's not a city unless it's registered with the state of Texas but that would be the only thing that would prevent another city from annexing that.
And people have done that. It's just a fair amount of work. And there's, you know, also the old law of any organization that isn't explicitly right wing sooner or later becomes left wing. You have to make sure that your new city doesn't wind up getting taken over by somebody who wants to wield its authority excessively. Right. And that's the terrible problem in libertarian folks. I know, you know, you run for office. I voted for other folks who run for office and I appreciate them. But your basic libertarian is not someone who enjoys running for office. And that's a big handicap in politics.
Yeah. And this actually takes me back to your story before, where these guys were, they were bidding. So you said it's kind of like a libertarian society where, or it's a voluntary society where people are bidding to take those offices, but they're still senators. So they're still writing laws. What kind of laws are they writing that would, like, is the government still voluntary? Because you mentioned things like, you know, laws about how they would get, I think you said, chips off and on, you know, in and out of the planet, which sounds like import and export laws and regulations. Yep. Are there taxes that go along with that? Are there restrictions on what you're allowed to import or how?
Well, okay. The U.S. has a bunch of non-taxation laws. You know, if you want to build an airplane, you know, you can build an airplane and just fly it yourself, and that's legal. But if you want to sell tickets to haul cargo, you know, to carry passengers or haul cargo, your plane needs to meet the FAA standards of safety. And yeah, they keep adding fees on, but even if you had no fees involved, you would still have an FAA inspector going through and checking out all of your paperwork and making sure that you have your plane safe. And, you know, we have examples. Boeing recently with the 737 MAX, you know, they decided to make a few safety features optional. And, you know, Americans have been flying, they flew on 737 MAXs that had those features because the airlines looked at them and said, oh, no, we don't want to have a single point failure. We want this redundant sensor. And so they didn't. Some third world airlines decided, well, if that's optional, we can probably do without it. And their planes went into the ground, killing hundreds of people. And that brought the FAA down on Boeing to say, wait a minute, what the hell were you doing that your planes are killing hundreds of people? And, you know, and Boeing's answer is like, well, if the pilots were properly trained so that they knew to recognize that the instrument, you know, readouts were lying to them, they would have been able to handle it just fine. And it's like, well, third world airlines don't have that level of training. They just trust that the thing will work because the American FAA went through and inspected everything. And that's why Boeing wound up not selling the MAXs for a while until that was fixed. And so that's the sort of law. What standards does a spacecraft have to meet? This is, you know, in the Torchship series, you have ships that can fly at, they can accelerate up to a, you know, percent, 1 or 2% of the speed of light. You do not want something smacking into your planet at 1% of the speed of light. That would leave a very big crater. That's the sort of thing where, you know, we don't care if there's passengers on your ship, we're going to shoot it down because it needs to be just dust when it reaches our planet, not a solid ship. So there's some serious safety hazards there. This comes up as a plot point, you know, when they're trying to escape a planet. It's like, okay, we're going to wait for four ships to take off because we know there's four anti-ship missiles at this port. And so once the first four go up, then we'll lift off because we know they're prepared to blow us off if we take off without permission, because the power of a spaceship is, you know, even more destructive than an airliner. And we saw on 9/11 just how destructive an airliner can be. It's a lot of power. It's a lot of danger. And if you have people crowded together, they're going to want to be kept safe from that. If you set up a homestead on Mars, you can have your own torch ship and no one's going to be around to be bothered if it explodes. If you have a, if you're in Elon Musk City and it has a population of 1 million people, those 1 million people are going to have strong opinions about someone bringing in his home-built spaceship to land on top of them. And so regardless of how you pay for it, you can pay for it entirely voluntary, but there's still going to be restrictions. Just like we have, you know, restrictions on shooting people. You know, you shoot somebody in town, there's going to be a whole bunch of consequences. And how we pay for the people investigating that is an entirely different problem. And one of the things I'm looking at in my seventh book coming out next month, which is Between Home and Ruin, there is a subplot where there, you know, there is a oppressed people under the censorate who will frequently not get law enforcement services. And so they wind up having to deal with crime on their own. And so they will do something along the lines of the Icelandic sagas, where you have blood prices paid from one clan to another, you know, to deal with a murder rather than, you know, arresting an individual. It's the clan who's held responsible. And so we get a look at a death creditor hired to investigate a murder, in this case to deal with the fact that she's being accused of responsibility for the murder and she's trying to find who's actually responsible and how to go ahead and do an investigation when you're not a salaried officer of the government, but a private individual who's going to get paid a percentage of the blood price for this crime. And so that's a way where you wind up dealing with crimes without having taxes. And so there's, you know, crime and safety regulations and stuff like that. There's a lot of stuff that is going to be, have to be handled by some sovereign. I mean, you could spin off the sewer system, you know, my city handles sewer and water services. That could be a private company. My kids go to government schools. They could be private schools. They could be spun off easily. But when you get down to stuff like safety regulations and law enforcement, you either have one sovereign or you're going to have feuding clans. I've seen some lovely stories, Werner Vinge's The Ungoverned, which you may have read, which, you know, has, you know, private law enforcement stuff. So you have a polycentric legal system, but, you know, it's kind of tossed in as a side. You have to have one system at the top to figure out how to resolve conflicts between the different legal systems, or you wind up just shooting it out, which is not the kind of situation most people want to live in.
Right. This is interesting because there's, you know, we, I guess going back a little bit, you know, when you talk about safety regulations and then you talk about crime. So like, there's a distinction here, right? Between like a crime, you steal something, you kill somebody, there's actual harm done versus safety. And there's an argument that a lot of people make, and I hear the argument made with like speeding or drunk driving or those sorts of things, that if you don't actually harm anybody, then it's not a crime because nobody's been harmed. But at the same time, there is, you know, like your example with the airplane, there is an increased danger and people aren't always aware of the danger. So if you're driving in traffic, you don't necessarily know that the guy next to you is drunk and maybe he looks like he's driving normally, but then, you know, maybe like a light turns red and he's not paying attention and he just goes through it. So there are like all of these dangers, but then also the same argument can be made. Yeah. But those same things will happen with people who aren't, you know, who aren't driving drunk. Sober people going through red lights. So it's not necessarily, you know, a fact of the increased danger there. But I think it is really interesting. And, you know, you talk about, you know, a spaceship going in the wrong direction at the speed of light, and crashing into a planet. When the potential is that big for danger, I don't know. What do you do about that? Because there's, in, you know, a lot of people will argue common law, and in common law, there's the actual crime where there's a victim, and then there's at least, they have, recklessness, which is, you know, basically acting in a very dangerous way that could harm. It doesn't actually cause harm to anybody yet, but it could harm. And even in common law, they try to solve that problem with that. So I think that is really an interesting kind of.
Yeah. I actually have some scenes, dealing with that in, the book that'll be coming out next summer. Currently untitled Space Opera 3. I'm going to come up with something better than that, I promise. But the scene is, we have, the Klan society has been liberated from the evil empire, and the liberators are trying to deal with stuff. And, you know, our hero who's spent enough time on the planet to learn how things works is explaining to the new government. It's like, no, they don't have driver's licenses. And it's like, and the governor's is like, okay, they don't have driver's licenses, but they're not wrecking cars all over the place. So what are they using instead of driver's licenses? And the explanation is, it's a clan system. Individuals are not responsible for their debts. Their clan is responsible. So if someone goes drunk driving, what happens is all the damage that he causes, his clan has to pay for. So you've got 200 people suddenly, you know, eating ramen and living in a tent because this one cousin decided to drive his car into a school bus. But in an individualist system like ours, you know, if I ram my car into a school bus, I cannot pay for the damage that I've done. And, you know, I can speak to this from the victim. You know, my family has been harmed in ways that the perpetrator could never repay. You know, and so the question is, if you have a blood price system, then it puts it on the clan of, okay, yeah, Cousin Eddie, he doesn't get to drive. You see Cousin Eddie, you know, having a beer, make sure he doesn't get his hands on the keys.
Right. And there's so that incentive because everybody else in the family is going to have to pay if he does anything.
Yeah. Now the flip side is, you know, there's a loss of freedom there because, yeah, I am not the most dexterous person. If I lived in one of those clans, they might say, it's like, Carl, you're a klutz. We're not letting you behind the wheel of a car. And so I could be 30 years old and having to hit up people to give me a lift. So it's a system where they're free from the government. They don't have the government making them, you know, jump through hoops to do that. But at the same time, it makes them very dependent on a clan. And so it's not something where you can just move off to another city for a better job because you are dependent on your clan. You have to be part of them. If you want to move to another city, you've got to marry into a clan in that city because, you know, you're always part of a clan. If you're an individual, you know, if there's no clan to watch for you, you know, people could just toss you to the sharks.
I feel like this is like, you know, especially when you talk about like marrying into other families, I feel like this is based on, you know, some of the reality of how some older societies, I mean, probably even still some societies today, would function. They have that sort of, maybe not necessarily like the clan system when it comes to crime, but they do have that sort of, you know, families are very close together and when you get married, then you're kind of extending the family, and it might have to do with wealth or power or protection or something like that that's shared. That people would, you know, this is why they would arrange marriages between two families, because, you know, the older people want these two families. It would be a great business partnership if they got together. All we have to do is find one of my kids and one of your kids, and we'll get them to get married, and now we have a partnership. How much of this is like, are you like a big historian in some of this stuff? And does a lot of this kind of come from that?
I am very fond of history. There's a bunch of history books and what you can see behind me. I've also done some, you know, historical reenacting to, you know, get a feel for it, which went into my book, The Lost War, which is based on a lot of that experience. But I have dug into history, and not just looking at histories of individual times and places, but trying to look at some of the big picture stuff of what are the forces that have driven history to take us from being hunter-gatherers to space travel. And there are books like, you know, Non-Zero and The Righteous Mind, and I am blanking on the name of Matt Ridley's book. His catchphrase for it was ideas having sex. But there's a bunch of interesting, concepts of what's driving for it. And, you know, people working together are much more powerful than, you know, just one person off by himself. I mean, my day job is making this incredibly complex aircraft. There's, you know, over 10,000 people working on it. And if you farm out, you know, if you look at all the people who sell us parts, there could be hundreds of thousands of people working on it, not just in the US, but abroad. And it's kind of, you know, just the basic iPencil thing, you know, to produce, you know, a piece of technology takes so many people contributing. And so we have this, you know, horrible conflict that to be free, you kind of need to be off on your own. But to enjoy the kind of thing where you can talk with someone over the internet and share that with however many viewers, you know, this is something, you know, lots of people went into supporting our internet connection and all of the software we're using. So there's a conflict there, and we're struggling to try and see what's the best resolution we can find for it. And I think one thing we can agree on is, excuse me, the amount of government we have right now is a bit more than we actually need for the Optima.
Absolutely. Awesome. So we're coming close to the end of the show, but I'm not really into like fiction books or fantasy I used to be as a kid. I used to love The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and those books. But like when it comes to reading, I'm usually like really on, I don't know, like political stuff or like mental stuff or marketing or, you know, kind of like more stuff that would help me, you know, be applicable in the real world. But I think like listening to how you're talking about these stories, and you know, even like I know like there's a lot of Trekkies that look at, like I've argued economics with them, and they say, well, we could have like a Star Trek based economy where the money's just, you know, there. And I think that's really interesting, because you're actually using fiction or science fiction, not just in like, you know, oh, this is a great like imaginary fantasy, but as a great way to look at other ways that government might function without having it actually exist in the real world like that. Like, you know, people are always saying, well, if the libertarian government was the best form of government, well, why haven't any of the other countries done that yet? And it's like, yeah, well, it hasn't happened yet. I mean, if space travel was the best thing, why wouldn't people have done that yet? Well, they're just starting to do it now. If living on the moon was the best thing, why wouldn't people have done it yet? Well, we're just now getting the technology for that. We're just now learning enough about humanity to get to the point where we can have voluntary societies, I think. So this is really interesting, and I'm actually really interested in your books now, even though I'm not a big fiction reader. And at the end of the show, I give everyone an opportunity, but I really want to know, where do I get your books? But go ahead and plug anything else you're working on also. If anyone's interested in learning more about you or your books, where can they find you? Where can they follow you? Et cetera.
Okay. Well, I have some announcements at kelthavenpress.com. That's Kelt, K-E-L-T. But the simplest way to find my books is to just go to Amazon and look for Carl K. Gallagher. The Torchship books are, my first trilogy. They were finalists for the Prometheus Award. They look at conflicts between, there's a bunch of, science fiction stuff and how do you deal with artificial intelligences and space travel, but it also looks at different kinds of governments. And there's a split in the third book that actually draws off Virginia Postrel's The Future and Its Enemies, looking at dynamist changing governments versus static governments in either the technocratic or the traditional form. The Lost War, I had an editor describe as hard poli-sci fiction in that I was, trying to look at it, what are we really dealing with as people try to organize themselves for survival? And so rather than having this huge, dozens of planets involved thing, this is looking at just a couple of hundred people, a group just large enough that Dunbar's law is breaking down and you can't all just get along. And so you have to actually have rules on, okay, here we are at the edge of starvation. Some teenager grabbed food out of somebody else's hand. How do you deal with that? And because that's a real problem, because you can't kill the guy, you need his labor, you can't let him get away with it, because then he'll do it again and more kids will do with it. What's a punishment that's acceptable that doesn't exceed the authority people have granted their government? Because if people get pissed off, the whole thing's going to dissolve in a brawl. What's the answer? And that's a real problem. And one of the great things about fiction is you can tackle this problem in a way that's much more easily assimilated by our hunter-gatherer brains than writing out some code to say, here's the logic tree of the problem. And so that's fiction. And my latest one out is Storm Between the Stars, which is a space opera novel where some people who had some involuntary exit, the dynamics of hyperspace cut them off from the rest of the human race for 900 years. And now the shoals of hyperspace have shifted and they discover that there is now a very nasty, oppressive government, the censorate, that wants to erase all of their books. And, because they realized, hey, 1984 has all of this work creating fake history. Why have fake history? Erase it all. You can write a book and people can read it for the rest of your life. And when you die, we erase the book. When a painter dies, we trash his paintings. History? There is no history. The censor has ruled for the past and the censor will rule for the future. That's all there is. And so, these people have come out of their exit and recontacted the rest of the human race and found this very nasty situation. So
that's a really scary thought. Cause if you think about, People could say like, books, whatever, art, whatever. But I mean, really think about like what history is. Like I've heard so many people say, if you don't know where you're coming from, you won't know where you're going. And if they were to imagine if they were to erase the history of the United States Supreme Court and all of its rulings, what would that do? Because even, I think that's, you know, we don't really, we look at the society we have today, and I don't think many people really put in the appreciation that what we have is the sum of everything that has happened in the past. And so if you were to just erase that, and we still reference that past, right? Like if there's, Supreme Court cases didn't just happen and then that's in the past. They're referenced every single day in every single trial. Like, mm-hmm. The Supreme Court says blah, 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 blah. That's what our legal system is. And to just erase that would change the course of every dispute resolution that we have in the future. That's pretty wild.
Yeah. And many of those are things constraining the government. So as the government erases mm-hmm. the past, they give themselves even more control.
Absolutely.
So that's why I have some space battles happening in the next book in the series. So we will see if folks like those.
Awesome. Well, I'm definitely going to check those books out now. You got my interest. You got me. I'm going to start reading poli-sci fiction. Sci fiction for the first time since I was a kid. That's you changed my life. I'm I never thought I'd be getting back into those books. But thank you so much for joining. This was a really awesome conversation. There's definitely a lot of really interesting thoughts and ideas that we've talked about. I want to see if you're listening to this show and you have any ideas based on what you heard. Send them in. I want to see what you're thinking based on this. Do you think some of these things would work? Do you have other alternatives? I think this is really an interesting seed conversation for some creative ideas, for some creative thinking, I think. But anyways, thank you so much for listening. If you like the show, make sure you share this with your friends. If you're listening to the podcast, make sure you subscribe and follow. Make sure you head over to the YouTube channel and the Facebook channel and subscribe and follow those as well. And we also we're launching a new YouTube channel called Tit Clips, Taxation is Theft Clips, Get Your Mind Out of the Gutter. And that's going to be some of the shorter clips from some of these shows, the highlights. So head over there and check that out as well. And of course, don't forget to support the show by heading over to taxationistheft.info and buying everything that we have in the store, because it's really awesome stuff. We've got some really cool keychains that we're going to be putting up there pretty soon, too. You'll never guess what they say on them. Taxation is theft. All right, guys. I will catch you next time.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.